Kings of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, the Battle of Arbela Gaugamela, Part 3. Now, gradually, the Macedonians closed with the Persians, never moving at faster than a walking pace. Darius watched as they edged away from the bulk of his chariots and towards his left flank. He responded, sending orders for his troops to move in the same direction and make sure that Alexander's right would be outflanked. As usual, our understanding of what followed breaks down after the deployment and preliminary moves, making a reconstruction of the Battle of Arbela Gaugamela highly conjectural. The name comes from the nearest substantial town. This was an especially confusing battle for those involved, with great numbers of cavalry charging and countercharging by squadrons rather than in neat blocks on our plans. The tens of thousands of hoofs throwing up clouds of dust so that visibility was often extremely poor. Arrian offers the most detailed and convincing narrative, while failing to explain much of what happened. He and all the other sources again fixate on Alexander and what he did. There is a fair chance that no one, least of all our sources written so long afterwards, truly understood the course of the fighting. As a result, this can be at best be simplified in a partial reconstruction. When some of the Persian left-wing cavalry began to envelop the Macedonians, the 400 or so Greek mercenary horsemen under Medeus, stationed on Alexander's right, wheeled to charge them in the flank. Before the battle, Alexander had given Medeus orders to do this on his own initiative if this occurred. The Persian envelopment halted, and instead, Sake and Bactrian squadrons countercharged. At the very least, these numbered a couple of thousand, and before long, Medeus and his small unit were chased back. Alexander had time to order the Paeonians to attack in turn, supported by the veteran mercenary infantry, who may well have been peltasts, more lightly equipped and more mobile than hoplites. The combination of cavalry with good infantry, able to throw or shoot missiles, and to form dense knots behind which tired horsemen could rally and reform to charge again, was often highly effective in the ancient world. The Persians gave back for a while and brought up more of their own supports, forgetting all thoughts of enveloping the Macedonian right. Even though outnumbered overall, Alexander's men held their own in very hard fighting, sucking in a disproportionately large number of opponents into a back-and-forth fight with no clear advantage on either side. The sickle chariots were heavily constructed, pulled by a team of four horses, and apart from the rotating sickles on each wheel that had blades and spears mounted on the end of the yoke, the drivers were not expected to fight, but to flog the horses, keep them running straight at the enemy. If the enemy were infantry and held together in close formation with spears or pikes thrust out in front, then the instinct of the horses would make them pull up short. But it took a steady nerve for a pikeman to do this as the noisy teams and vehicles came bearing down. At Cuxia in 401 BCE, the 10,000 had shown such nerve and rendered the chariots useless. At Gaugamela Arbela, Darius's chariots probably started earlier than planned, so had to go further, and the Macedonians matched the coolness of the famous mercenaries. Alexander had ordered the hypaspists and pikemen to open lanes in their formation to let the chariots through, just as they had done in the face of Thracian wagons rolled down the slopes in Alexander's first campaign as king. The horses naturally swerved to run through the gap rather than into the solid-looking wall of soldiers. Elsewhere, especially in front of the cavalry, who could not easily use the same ploy, light infantrymen shot down horses and drivers. Curtius and Diodorus could not resist gruesome attacks of limbs and heads being lopped off, both Macedonian and Persians, when some chariots turned around and fled. But the truth seems to be that the chariots inflicted hardly any casualties at all. Once past the phalanx, the chariots, their teams beginning to tire, and the drivers confused, were dealt with by light infantry and the grooms waiting to support the companion cavalry. The chief purpose of the chariots was not to kill, but to disrupt the phalanx and open the way for cavalry charges. This they utterly failed to do, and by the time the main line of Persian cavalry came forward, they were confused by the ranks of spears and sarissa points as the hypaspis and phalanx resumed their advance. Yet the shift to the right during the advance meant that the Macedonian left was threatened even more seriously than at Issus. Parmenio was soon outflanked, and the Thessalians had a tough fight against far greater numbers of horsemen. Some Persians went right through or around the Macedonian army and attacked their camp, although the story of a deliberate raid to release Darius' family and his mother's refusal to leave with her rescuers is highly unlikely, not the least because such captives were surely at a strongly fortified main camp some distance from the battlefield. With the whole of the Macedonian left flank under threat, there was no question of advancing there, and the two leftmost regiments of the phalanx halted to keep in alignment with the cavalry and other troops on the wing. The rest of the first line pushed on, exacerbating the natural tendency for a large phalanx to fracture into its constituent units during a long advance. A wide gap opened, letting some Indian and Persian cavalry charge through. Most of the horsemen kept going, failing to wheel and attack the phalanx from the side or the rear, and they even found another gap in the second line. Servants were killed and the baggage animals panicked before units from the second line responded, obeying orders issued before the battle. They turned and drove the enemy away. So at this point, the battle is kind of open. Anything could happen at this point. So next time, we'll finish up the battle. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arians, The Campaigns of Alexander, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood, The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.